This week's episode was brought to you by Zolt Zandor. Maybe the best name I've ever read aloud. Thank you, Zolt Zandor. It's with the generous support of listeners just like you that helps keep our team of intrepid researchers stocked with enough Lemurian phase crystal modulators to keep opening bigger and heavier passageways in the ancient subterranean pyramid complex located beneath Antarctica, inhabited with four-dimensional alien ghosts who we keep finding ingenious ways to deceive into writing this show. If you'd like to help us explore Antarctica, or just hear the second half of this episode, then please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will not only get you the extended version of this episode, but all our episodes that are now easily accessible natively within Spotify. But that's not all. I'll send you a 5x5 high-quality super deluxe sticker of our Big Bunny Baphomet cover art and the secret keys to our Discord server, where you can share cat photos with other listeners and even the hosts of the show. On this week's episode, we dive back into the esoteric teachings of chaos magic by reviewing the occult classic Advanced Magic for Beginners by Alan Chapman, stopping to discuss the menagerie of topics in each chapter and giving the curious seeker a leg up on where to start with their own magic practice. We start from the basics of what magic really is, the tools you need to advance rapidly in your quest, and the important information needed to fuel your journey, explained in a way that pretty much anybody can understand. In the free section of the show, we discuss what's even possible with magic, exercises and experiments you can do right away, and a no-nonsense crash course on how to start designing your own spells. We discuss Kabbalah, choosing a suitable magic name, synchronicity, basic magic, laws, and even some gematria. In the extended episode, we discuss the important features of the astral realm, the etheric body, lucid dreaming, how to work with spirits, demons, and even get in touch with your own holy guardian angel, whatever that is. We keep going and even explain the details of creating your own familiars, the stages of initiation a magician eventually passes through, and the prevailing theories about the dawning of a new era. Thank you, and enjoy the show. To the bad-tempered witch.
I don't know what.
She flew off the handle.
Oh, the broom.
Why couldn't the water wizard feel the magic?
I don't know why.
I don't know.
Because he was having a dry spell.
Okay, that's pretty good.
How many magicians does it take to do magic?
One.
You're right, just one will do the trick.
What do you call someone who manages the money of an organization that practices black magic?
An occultant?
No.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Whole Rabbit, where we don't just behave like ontological terrorists without apology or explanation. Nay, we take minds hostage with guerrilla metaphysics and submit to the world our philosophical protocols of chaos for immanentizing the Eschaton. Because this week, we're discussing Alan Chapman's occult classic, Advanced Magic for Beginners. If you don't have a copy, please go back in time and attain one now. I'm your host, Luke Madrid, better known as the Hack Rabbit. I'm joined this week by the mechanic of militarized memes, Mari Sama.
Heyo.
And the musical mutant metallurgist, Malcor 5.
What's up?
I thought for this week, it would be fun to discuss the practice of magic as a whole, but in a way that was appropriate for both starry-eyed beginners, the dutiful dabbler, and the open-minded adept. As it turns out, an in-depth look at Alan Chapman's Advanced Magic for Beginners proved to be the perfect way to do just that.
That's an interesting title. It's a bit of a contradiction.
Well, I think one of his motivations for writing it was for how many books were out there for the beginner magician that existed to set you pretty much on the path to nowhere, where he wanted to be accessible to newbies, but also be deadly honest about where it's all going, what you can expect, and how you can get to the fun parts right away, like right out the gate.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it because he basically gives you an introduction or like a taste of each path and like how it works. It's just so the beginner doesn't get so lost and that they're oriented and they know what path they're going to take first. Because like you said, beginner's books are oversaturated and it's hard to know where to start.
Yeah, he does a really good job of mixing in the humor, like it's almost satirical at times, with the raw message of why you're doing stuff. And it transcends just a normal message, like at the same time.
Yeah, it's not like boring and like, oh, here's the facts, basically. He kind of keeps you looped in with the way that he describes things in a very, he's very teasing sometimes. It's fun to read.
Right. And it's from the get-go too. Like even the cover of the book, there's a grenade on it. And I think the grenade is a perfect symbol for this title, you know, Advanced Magic for Beginners. You know, that's kind of funny, right? How are you going to give advanced magic to beginners? That's not what you're... It's like, okay, well, a grenade is a very destructive device that anybody can use. It's like it requires very simple functionality and it can cause a high amount of damage. It's an advanced piece of technology in the hands. I like that he put that on the cover of the book.
Yeah, because most magic books, you're either going to insult the intelligence of the beginner or you're gonna, like, in Crowley's case, get them killed. You know, give them all the rituals in the wrong order, get them excited about getting into all the wrong stuff, and then just see who survives. Usually the smuggest, luckiest, and most pretentious among them. And that's who we get to discuss. No, this is a much better approach. It's in the same wheelhouse as Phil Hines' Condensed Chaos or Peter Carroll's Liber Nulb. It's very straight and to the point. It's very practical. And it allows us to talk about magic as a whole without leaving anything out, which I think is very special. And I suggest anyone who's into magic, pick up this book and check it out.
I really enjoyed it because the way the topics are written, it's like a smorgasbord of everything, like a all-you-can-eat buffet of magic.
So let's grab those soggy spring rolls and get started. As with any work of classical literature, the journey begins at the introduction. Here, Alan Chapman initiates the conversation by asking the all-important question, what is magic? By orienting ourselves in the history of its development and calling us to action by pointing out that now, despite a fundamental widespread confusion about its nature, is the best time to get started finding out, he says. Investigating the Western tradition of magic can be confusing at the best of times, let alone for a person who is at the beginning of their magic journey. There is near impenetrable transcendentalism of the early 20th century magical texts, the moralistic environmentalism of the modern pagan movement, the popular naive sentimentality of the New Age, and the almost cartoon-like practical materialism of some postmodern authors. Where are we supposed to look for a basic introduction to magic when there doesn't appear to be a consensus on what magic is, let alone a reason for why we might want to practice it? However, this confusion around the fundamental nature of magic is, in itself, actually a fairly recent development. Historically, magic has a very specific purpose as a 2,000-year-old sacred tradition peculiar to the West, beginning in Hellenistic Greece, where it was taught by the likes of Plato and Plotinus. It was absorbed into Christianity by Pseudo-Dionysus, then forced underground to become alchemy during the Dark Ages. It resurfaced through John Dee and Rosicrucianism in the 16th century, and later manifested as the European occult revival of the 19th and 20th centuries. Over the years, it has survived near extinction through religious persecution and deliberate misrepresentation. Today, it has to contend with the rot of extreme postmodernism, which is the principal cause of the tradition's current obfuscation. Postmodern thought is often misunderstood, and the concept of pluralism, the recognition of many contexts, and the understanding that no one context is privileged in and of itself, is often confused with the absurd notion that every approach, culture, and tradition is commensurate and of equal merit. In terms of magic, the purpose and teachings of our magical heritage in the West has been replaced with this extreme ethical standpoint. And some magicians even claim that the Western tradition is actually a syncretic mishmash of any and all the magic religions practiced in the West. Is it any wonder we can't find a basic consensus on what magic is?
Yeah, I like that he pointed it out in this way, and that the different practices and, I guess, branches of tradition in magic, they're all interconnected in some ways. Like, they're all describing the same truth, but they use different tools, approaches, metaphors, symbols, etc. And that's largely how I really got into magic, is because I was already into religions in that way. I love studying how similar they were underneath all of the, you know, flowery language. And to me, that was a perfect way to explain why magic is so scattered these days.
Yeah, and what I got from it is he's essentially saying that all religions are, you know, especially the big ones, you know, the ones that are dominating the West, like he's saying, they're all just as valuable as each other. They're all just as bad and as good as each other. There's room to assume that he's also saying that all these religions have interpretations and there is a one truth behind all of it, but none is like better than the other exclusively.
Yeah.
We want to have our cake of postmodernism, being able to break down each one and find its similarities, but we also want to eat it too, by acknowledging that they're all uniquely different, have different cultural frameworks, and actually lead to something, where postmodernism tends to break something down until it's just like, what are we even messing with it for? So following this train of thought from the introduction, Advanced Magic for Beginners advocates for a method of chiseling away at the confusion about what magic really is, by embarking on a personal journey of self-discovery, which, as Chapman points out, falls in line with the core philosophy of what has come to be known as chaos magic. This eloquently describes chaos magic as the spiritual equivalent of what kids today call FAFO, or around and find out, which, all things considered, works quite well as an apt description for what chaos magic is. Likewise, Peter Carroll is praised for his seminal work of 1978 dubbed Liber Null, which usually comes packaged with his equally powerful addendum, Psychonaut. And I agree that it deserves credit for helping preserve the magic tradition of the West by sweeping away the convoluted superciliousness of older paradigms enjoyed by either the privileged or the lazy and self-important armchair magician, while simultaneously attracting the masses to experiment. Chapman, on the one hand, celebrates the introduction of postmodernism into magic, which allows us to see the cultural relativity of different magic systems, but warns us that it also has gone too far, reducing the idea of magic to little more than a theory, ignoring well-established paradigms, and overemphasizing material results as the be-all, end-all of modern practice. Likewise, this begs the question which introduces the first chapter. If we're to commence around to find out, what honestly should we expect?
It's fun time! It's fun time!
Now, before any questions are answered, Chapman opens the chapter by demonstrating how he deals with such matters when the topic rears its head out in the wild.
So in the book, he writes, "Below are the two most frequently asked questions about magic with my answers.
What is magic?
There isn't a man, woman, or child on this planet that does not know what magic is. Don't ask silly questions.
Does magic work?
No."
At the point of some insightful teasing, we are ultimately called to begin answering these questions for ourselves before being given the good news, despite some peculiar nuance. You will get exactly what you ask for.
Careful what you wish for.
Careful! Be very, very careful! But not too careful. Nextly, explaining the nuance, he warns, it is not entirely unlike explaining what sex will be like to a virgin. They may understand what you're saying well enough, but they won't entirely get it until they experience it for themselves. Then, to take the metaphor a bit further, it's silly to expect mastery right away, changing the metaphor to music. If your first plucking of Twinkle Twinkle Little Star in the ukulele feels like a miracle of effort, don't feel so self-assured that pieces like Beethoven's Ninth are beyond the scope of what is possible. In short, while magic wishes will only find their fulfillment through what means are available, don't be too quick to assume your first results are as good as they could ever be, or even so sure about what the limits of reality truly are. If you continue earnestly, you can expect some surprises about both. In fact, these surprises are some of the biggest, most important benefits that magic can offer you. Revelation, either about yourself or the world you inhabit. For example, if you cast a spell to fly like Superman and you don't happen to fall out of a window during a business formal, then you are likely to fulfill this wish in a dream. Well, I think that's a bit dramatic. Drawing from my own experience, if you wish to fly like Superman, you may suddenly discover, having entirely missed the hype, your favorite game developer just released the latest Superman video game. Or maybe an unusual acquaintance invites you, maybe even pays for you, to go skydiving. And upon your first jump, the instructor you're strapped to pulls a chute to reveal a giant S logo.
Oh.
So the idea is, by doing magic, you might not be able to throw fireballs out of your eyes, sad to say, but you may just surprise yourself how in alignment the universe is capable of giving you your wish or your intention in ways that you frankly could not have foreseen, and that's one of the biggest reasons to do it, because you learn about the universe, and you learn about what is possible, which expands your horizons, something that everybody wants to experience. Everyone wants to have their mind blown. This is a great way to blow your own mind.
Well, you know, I think a simple way to blow somebody's mind is, like, you know, ask the question, are dreams relevant? You know, if you throw a fireball or fly in a dream, isn't that just as valid as your awoken mind experiencing it? You're still conscious while you're dreaming sometimes, and you can remember these things. What's the difference between, you know, the experience? There's no difference between the experience, you know, you can still remember it in a certain way.
Well, not only that, even if you don't remember your dream, the fact that you experienced it, your subconscious kind of takes that in anyway. So I like that he likens dreaming to being part of the act of magic as well, because, you know, if it's physically impossible, then it's likely to happen there. And if it does, it literally has happened to you. Like, your subconscious interprets that as something that has actually happened.
Alan Chapman sums it up thusly. The experience of a magical result will reveal something very odd about the nature of reality. This will have a transformative effect. Your previous view of reality and yourself must necessarily change as a result of that experience. It follows then that the more you do magic, the more you will encounter revelation, and the more you will be transformed. It must be stressed that intellectual comprehension or explanation reveals or changes nothing. If you want to know the truth, you must experience it. Magic is one way of experiencing truth. To summarize greatly, chapter 1 concludes by warning that, like the truth, magic is not for everyone. And if you around long enough and hard enough, finding out can be dangerous, even to the point of losing one's mind.
How about that one?
I can agree with Chapman that for the dabbler, this sounds, well, hyperbolic at first. But as you wade deeper and deeper, it becomes a sincere risk. In my case, I had a revelation that slapped me so hard, I called it a theophany. Its effects were permanent, in a good way, but on either side of this priceless occurrence, I paid with sanity, friendships, and reputation I will never fully recover. In this particular case, it was absolutely worth it, while in others, not so much. So, like, I've sacrificed for some stuff, and oftentimes I'm left feeling like, oh, that probably wasn't worth it. But in this case, I paid a lot more, and it was worth it. Magic is worth doing. It is worth around to find out.
Yeah, it's true. And I mean, I think I've told this story before on the podcast, but even before I started studying magic in college, I took on Lilith as a patron god.
Oops.
Yeah, I knew to approach and be very respectful. But as I was reading this, I realized I've up a lot. And I asked for knowledge and protection, but I did not give her an offering and I did not banish. So actually, essentially what I got is like a relationship that was really electric. And it was like meeting myself and another person. It was really invigorating. And then it's like the biggest heartbreak of my life. And that's what led me into actually studying magic and stuff. So she did end up teaching me a lesson, but it took so much time out of my life that I found other stuff, you know, and making myself better. But I kind of got stuck in that trap, but coming out on the other side, and I literally was transformed after that relationship ended. And that's when I started looking into it and started listening to the show, and everything came together for me afterwards.
Chapter 1 also warns that magic has many diverse expressions in both culture and as individuals that a fledgling magician will have to choose from and exist within. For instance, in America, you can work towards becoming a vampire without fear of public execution and feed your power on weeknights playing in dive bars and a Sister of Mercy cover band, if you so choose. We've all seen these people. You also could just become a priest. You could go join a seminary. There's lots of options for you. This brings us to chapter 2. Now, the first and perhaps most powerful tool a magician needs in their arsenal is, of course, the magic journal, the most feared and reviled of all magical weapons. After all, wasn't the point of graduating high school so we would never, ever have to write again?
I mean, that's what I thought. I'm so bad at this, though. I really need to get back on it. Quoting from the book, it is traditional for the magician to write down every magical act, result, and experience in the magical diary, which functions as a tool of encouragement, a scientific record, and a means of magical integration.
While it's easy to fall prey to laziness, a magician must overcome. Some benefits of having a magical journal include a goad to continue practicing. Without a record, it's easy to forget how long it's been since you've done a working. If you regularly keep a journal, you are regularly doing magic, which, like working out, is what you need to do in order to stay in shape.
Next, it's a record you can use to identify strengths and eliminate weaknesses. What works? What does not work? If you catch yourself in a bind but can't remember what helped the last time, well, you've learned nothing. You gotta keep leveling up.
What does the scouter say about his power level? It's over 9,000! What, 9,000?!
You can also start to keep track of like actual percentages of your spell workings being successful or failing, because you can count the times you banished, count the times you invoked, you know, particular energies. Did it work or not? And you can actually tally it out and figure out a percentage, I guess.
You tally up all your stats on your great magical Excel sheet and realize that the pigeon god always seems to ignore your supplications. It's because you have Horus on your altar and he's afraid of falcons. Next, you may discover niches you're headed down, for better or for worse. Do you use candle magic almost exclusively, but to little effect? Do you avoid conjuration despite always having good results? Etc., etc. It's like, oh god, every time I talk to Andrew Malik, my butthole bleeds. I gotta do it more.
Alan Chapman also says this. It should also be noted that today's slightly insignificant but odd occurrence is tomorrow's mind-bending synchronicity. If you don't write it down, you may miss something very important.
Yeah, like what if that weird dream you had was actually giving you the secret key to attaining like those top five things on your wish list and you just didn't record it? So
yeah, and I find that it's hard to recall specific things, so having the stuff written down, you can go read it again and say, oh well, here's where I did A, B, and C wrong, or I would do this differently. I mean, it really is a good idea.
As a musician, the most magical thing you could do is to notate your song, you know, correctly, and it's on the record, so should you ever forget or you, I guess, pass away, you've recorded a master album and you know they can listen to it forever. That's magic, right? Music is magic.
Yeah,
and so is the record. Now, without a journal, revelatory experiences also tend to fade somewhat rapidly. By recording them, and perhaps most importantly, the circumstances which surround the experience, you gain a much better chance of integrating these experiences into your normal life and actually give them an opportunity to repeat. So, according to Alan, the first exercise goes as thus. You write down every act of magic that you do, including the actual method used, and lastly, the results obtained. Should you need one, here's an example of one of the diary entries, like December 3rd, 2008, 14:21 p.m. Who uses military time? Sigil method description. Creating a sigil from the statement, I will find my house keys. Used concentration practice for gnosis. Found it difficult to forget the sigil afterwards, but this didn't take as long as last time. In a later diary entry, it might say, December 4th, 2008, at 10 a.m. Result from sigil from December 3rd, 2008. David just phoned, said he found a set of keys in the back of his car, and wondered if they were mine. My favorite story about the lost keys is Peter Carroll, who said he got so mad. He just was like pulling his hair out angry, and his keys just appeared behind him. This fell out of the sky and dropped on the floor behind him. It can happen, I guess.
Interesting.
On to chapter 3. But what about magic itself? Where do we get started? Sigils, of course. If you want to start experimenting with real magic, you probably should create a sigil. And like all basics, mastery of the simple is the only path to mastering the complex. Chapter 3 covers this in some depth. He says, creating a sigil is easy. First, you need to write down your wish or intent as a statement in the first person and present tense, as if said wish has already been fulfilled. For instance, I want gold is not as good as I have a chest full of gold. A sigil of the first sentence will lead to wanting more gold, while a sigil of the second will lead to actually having a chest full of gold.
Do you want gold?
Once the desire is written down in this way, you want to make it into a sigil or glyph that makes your brain go, whoa. This is often accomplished by writing the intention down, removing any vowels or repeating letters into a magical looking symbol. From my experience, it greatly helps if it looks magical to you. For me, it's actually a requirement. The next step, of course, is to charge it. As explained in the first few pages of Liber Null, there are excitatory and inhibitory methods. Well, in both cases, the idea is to focus your consciousness. This can be achieved by slowing it down as much as possible, or exciting it as much as possible, using the sigil as a center point. Alan Chapman, as many chaos magicians suggest, recommends using the climax at the point of orgasm to visualize the sigil, and often it works spectacularly. After all, just 100 years ago, this was a well-guarded secret, but now the cat is long out of the bag. Thank you, Aleister Crowley. The next step is to shift your focus away from the working, ideally forgetting the entire thing, especially the sigil. This prevents the lust of result from ruining the outcome. Lastly, you want to record the results in your little journal there. Afterwards, Chapman suggests a series of exercises intended to help the user decide if this method is sacred or subject to modification.
Chapman says, ask yourself, is there a secret mechanism to how magic works? Is there an unfathomable mystery hidden in the omission of repeated letters? Do you really believe in a cosmic committee for the correct sigilization process?
Following this train of thought leads to exercise 3. Chapman says, the pen and paper. Number 1, think about something you want to occur and then mentally state it. 2, now randomly create, using your imagination, an abstract glyph. 3, decide that the glyph represents that statement. Now you have a sigil. Number 4, go charge it and wait for the result. And finally 5, record the outcome. Was it different? Assuming you had a successful result of some capacity, we can even break the process even more than we just broke it. Afterwards, we test yet again. Does it still work? For instance, you take the last sigil, decide that it means something entirely different, and then try charging it again. And if you do, you will likely discover that the outcome actually changes. It's not something objective about the sigil itself. And this will allow the magician to realize that it doesn't have to be a sigil. It could be a combination of numbers, a word, a gesture, or even a choreographed dance sequence. With this in mind, this essentially turns how you do magic into a matter of aesthetics. In the next chapter, Chapman takes this postmodern reductionism to its extreme and gives us a good fundamental instruction of performing nearly any act of magic. It's only 6 steps long. First, you decide what you want to occur. 2, you ensure that what you want to occur has a means of manifestation. 3, you choose an experience. 4, you decide that this experience means the same thing as what you want to occur. So this would be like making the sigil or using a hand sign that means the same thing as the experience you're wishing for. That's what he's saying. 5, you perform the act. You undergo the experience. And 6, you get the result and then record it. So if we really look at this broken down model, it can be applied to pretty much any act of magic. And it even reminds me a bit of how Anton LaVey explains magic. His whole idea being the psychological decompression chamber, you want to act out your desire or your wish in such a way that you feel comfortable forgetting it and letting go of it, which then allows it to arise. And it operates on the same principle. It's just not as reduced as what Chapman says, but the idea is the same. You decide what you want, and then you represent that in your own special way in the ritual chamber, however you want. And if you listen to what Anton LaVey says, the more you can feel like you did experience the thing that you wish, the better it'll work out. But I digress. So on to chapter 5. Having established the rules of magic are far from absolute, Chapman introduces 4 methods, which are, according to him, often described as immutable laws. With this in mind, they are still useful and worth consideration, even if, as he argues, they're not necessarily immutable. You don't need to use these 4 laws. Each one can sort of work without the other, and he explains how.
So number 1, the sympathetic method. From cave paintings of a successful hunt to your ex's head on a dartboard, the belief in like causing like is perhaps as old as man himself. Sympathetic magic is wonderful for encouraging or developing magical innovation. For instance, if you wanted to get rid of your boss, do you acquire a set of action figures and play out an office drama of what you want to happen? Or do you draw a little picture of him, chew it up and spit it out your office window? To be crude, it is true that like causes like, but it's also true that unlike causes like. Consider the use of the nonsensical sigil as outlined in chapter 3. It's painfully obvious, even after the most cursory consideration of the concept of similarity, that to equate 2 things is a decision made by the magician. Do you think that there is a universal similarity department run by a crack team of elemental inspectors who will descend upon the doodle of your boss to measure how well you've captured his likeness?
Yes.
This guy's great. Just as similarity is a decision, so is the meaning of an event. Whether it's playing with an action man or slapping yourself on the forehead with a banana, if you decide the experience means your boss will bugger off, then he will. You just need to make the decision and perform the action. A magical act does not need to be sympathetic to the desired result in order for it to work.
Apostasy.
I like his pragmatic approach because that's very much how I am. It's just like, no, just make sure it happens, like what you want. Like, fuck all the hoping and praying stuff. Like,
just do it.
This is helpful for me because if the sigil isn't perfect, I'll just keep doing it over and over and over again.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to have all these associations and stuff with actual planetary magic and all that stuff. Like, despite what another book might tell you, I like to say magic is yours, and like these personalized sigils, these nonsensical sigils are the best, like, because they change over time. You put them away, you lose them, and you forget about that, and then you pick them up a couple years later as a scrap of paper, and you're like, wow, I remember this completely, because it's like embedded inside you, it feels.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to totally forget what your magic working was or a sigil. I really struggle with that.
Oh, I'm good at it. I still have one hanging in my kitchen, and I don't know what it means anymore, but it's still there.
It means bacon. So this brings us to the second law or method that magicians, quote, must use. Commonly, when working magic on a specific person, place, or thing, a material artifact of said target is often considered essential. This is called the magical link, according to Alan Chapman. While it might be helpful to have somebody's toothbrush or fingernails, writing their name or creating a clay simulacrum is just as effective. And as we just discussed in the first magical law, the clay simulacrum doesn't really have to be exactly like what you're aiming at. Although if you do have somebody's fingernails, the universe can't really question who it is you're sending this, you know, spell to, because it's their fingernails. It's very specific. So
yeah,
it's helpful to have a magic link, as it said, but you also do not need one.
Especially if the person has like a generic name and you're just using like your own signature version of their name on a piece of paper. And if you have like John Doe's fingernail, like, you're not going to just resurrect some other John Doe, you know?
Exactly. Whereas, like, if that first John Doe was really ready to be resurrected, well, it's more likely to happen. So, in some cases, it helps to have a magic link, but it's not necessary, really. Then, this leads us to number three, the Gnosis method. The term Gnosis was popularized by Peter Carroll and has since become a staple of chaos magic, often referring to an altered state of mind, usually a singular focus that can be projected towards the result of the working, like in the case of charging a sigil. Chapman is clear that while this is a functional method, and he's even suggested it in the exercises prior, it's not a feature of some schools of magic, especially from the African or Caribbean ones. I found this to be a bit surprising. In short, Chapman boils down Gnosis into a method which safeguards against lust for result by catapulting the magician into a state of direct experience, reminding the reader that the true secret of magic is the experience itself.
I love that so much that he points that out, because I often forget about it, that you just need to do it and get into it.
I thought that was refreshing, that let's say you put all your effort into making the perfect ritual. If you're not like all spun out and feeling it the way you imagine, but you do it faithfully, it will still work. And the opposite is true too. Like, if you catapult yourself into that magical state of mind, but you don't have all the accoutrement, it'll also work. It doesn't make one approach more valid than the other. Of course, it does help to combine methods if you are able. And then number four, and I'm sort of surprised to see this here. He calls it the amnesia method. Frequently, one is instructed that forgetting a working sigil or intention is important to have it come to fruition. We just spoke on this. And while this is true in various systems, it is usually ascribed to allowing the desired outcome to enter the subconscious, where it can take root and begin manifesting itself unimpeded. Often, this is further explained as ridding oneself of lust for result, which most experienced magicians will identify as a killer of desired outcomes. Like, if you really, really, really want something, it's not going to work out. Chapman explains that this is due to the fact that wanting something is a strong qualifier that you do not have it, which clashes with the intention of the working, which is stated in the present tense as if it's already been accomplished. So it's like the two things are fighting each other. I want this thing that I don't have, and I have this thing. They just sort of cancel each other out. So that's one big reason you might want to forget it, but I usually don't find it's possible to forget it. And this is where Anton LaVey comes in and is like, dude, you need to make the ritual so psychologically satisfying that the intense desire is actually somewhat snuffed by the ritual itself. And that's like a surefire way of getting past this hump.
I don't know if you guys know about like law of attraction and the law of like abundance versus scarcity. If you put out the vibe that you don't have something, then you're less likely to come in contact with it or attain it. This is also shown to be psychologically true when you're talking about either relationships or attaining success or money or whatever.
This might sound from left field, but if we look to what Jesus says in the Gospels of Thomas, he says, whoever has something in hand will be given more, and whoever has nothing will be deprived of even the little they have.
Also, with self-help and bettering yourself, like a method that works really well is imagining that you're already at the point that you want to be. And that's a way of kind of getting away from that wanting feeling to make it manifest.
Let's see, between the secret, Jesus Christ, chaos magic, and Satanism, this law is more or less the same.
Yeah.
This brings us to chapter 6. And chapter 6 deals with a topic that's central to chaos magic, and in some cases has come to define it. Frankly, I found this particular topic to be a bit confusing, along with the entire chapter, but the book does break it down fairly well. Nonetheless, I'll do my best to summarize. In short, belief matters and arises from experience, and it can be changed or reinforced by acting in accordance with the desired belief. It's a bit of a chicken or the egg scenario. We act on our beliefs, and our beliefs inform our actions. One example given is that in order to believe life is joyful, the one must act as if it were true frequently enough to begin experiencing the statement as if it were true. A little bit of fake it until you make it, to be honest. Yep. I've heard it better explained by New Age channelers like Abraham Hicks, who says that belief is just a thought you think regularly enough, while our actions are nothing more than a crystallization of our thoughts. In essence, belief shifting is just doing this in reverse. Act as if something is true until you begin to think it is. And then once you think it is, it becomes true.
It will be, yeah.
As an example, if you want to believe in God, then start praying to God. Using God as an explanation does not count. This is an important part of Alan Chapman's entire message. Like, it's not enough to explain how something works. You have to experience it. Like, what you think happened, your explanation of it doesn't really matter. He says, if all you need to do is act on a belief to make it true, then if you want to live in a happy, wonderful world, all you need to do is act like you live in a happy, wonderful world. This can be anything from a full-blown ritual act to something as simple as telling yourself the world is a fun, good place to be. Of course, just saying this once won't change much. Try it and see how fast you revert back to thinking and acting as if the world isn't a happy, wonderful place. In order to work magic on the self effectively, you must replace the habitual magic that you do every day with new habitual magic. This means repetition. So I was trying to think of a concrete example of this. Let's take the person who espouses a disbelief in the supernatural, but then also refuses to play with a Ouija board out of abject fear. The act of avoiding the Ouija board is a better reinforcement in the belief of spirits than an intellectual rationalization that they do not exist. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like, if you are afraid of ghosts and modify your behavior in accordance with that fear, it doesn't matter what you intellectualize about ghosts. Your truth is that ghosts are real because you act on it. I just had to put that out there. I hope some people heard that.
As a person who doesn't believe in ghosts, I'm not going to do anything to try to mess with them, if that makes sense. I don't know if what I do will make them real.
See, that's what we're saying. You could make them real, Malachor. That's what I'm saying.
Malachor, you believe.
You're a believer.
I don't believe in them, so therefore they don't exist, right?
No.
No, no. Your experience of them is what matters. So if you modify your behavior in accordance with the idea that they may exist, then they may exist.
He's avoiding the experience as not to manifest them, I guess.
Well, it's just reality. It's like, maybe I just look at it like it's no big deal. Like, if they are here, then it's like they're also not here, and it's just I go about my day, and they're not trying to kill me, it seems, right now.
You should try pissing on a grave sometime.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's stupid, right? Like, this is disrespectful. Like, that's not something I would do. Like,
do it to like a criminal's grave.
You need people like me.
I use the same idea with fundamentalist Christians who run around calling everything the devil and being like, oh, the devil will get you if you do that, or this is Harry Potter's the devil, D&D is the devil, everything is the devil. Those people that talk about the devil more than they talk about God, they actually believe in the devil more than they believe in God. If you are worried about the devil constantly, it's because you believe in it. Whether you say you believe in it or can intellectualize it or not, or if you say you believe in Jesus Christ, but you think the devil like 1,000 times more a day than you think about Jesus Christ, you believe more in the devil than you do Jesus Christ. Straight up.
Yep.
Or like those guys who are into being manly because they're so worried about being feminine.
Like MRAs?
It's because they're homosexual and don't want to admit it. There, I said it.
Oh, shots fired.
That's gay. I don't hug my kids because that's gay. Well, guess what, dude? You're gay. I'm just saying. But yeah, shots fired. Nothing wrong with being gay. That's my whole point. It's okay to be gay.
There was actually a scientific study that they tested homophobes with like straight pornography and gay pornography, and they got more turned on than actual out of the closet gay guys.
Definitely.
For the gay stuff.
I totally believe it. They are so into it. And the problem's not that they're into it. It's that they project their hatred of being into it on others.
That's the problem.
Yes.
No, no, no.
No! No, 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 no! No!
I just got somebody so mad right now. Sorry, not sorry. And then these next two are getting into some slightly more advanced territory, which is a lot of fun. Chapter 7 is all about magic mottos and oaths.
Chapman says, once we get past the allure of magical culture, a magical name or motto serves a very specific and irrefutable magical function. And the funny or serious nature of a name bears this out. Magical name is the sum of the magician's approach, understanding, and experience of magic. It is impossible for it to be anything else.
In short, one's magical name often determines the overarching themes and motifs that accompany one's magical career for the duration of its use. This is, after all, why it's also usually called the magic motto.
It's something that you have to take very seriously, apparently. Like, if you name yourself something, like, you're going to magically be all about that. And just the same as your motto.
Let's say you're a chef, and your special chef name is Butter Catapult Boy. You have to slap butter on everything. That's what you do.
Or else somebody's going to challenge you for the name.
And then it's not your name anymore. Somebody else is going to be slapping butter on stuff. So for me, anytime I get lost, I can come back to Hack Rabbit and remind myself what it is I'm all about.
He says, whatever the circumstances of your adopted magical persona, there is no escaping the fact that the magical name determines who you are as a magician. And it should be acknowledged that the identity you have chosen is an act of magic performed on the self.
Now, the corresponding exercise to this chapter goes thus. Number one, devise and adopt a magic name you are comfortable with using the means you find most suitable. Two, once created, investigate what the name says about your approach, perception, and understanding of magic. Record the results from adopting this name, and this will be an ongoing process. You hear that, Butter Boy? Three, revise your magical name as and when necessary.
Yeah, that's a good addition there at the end.
It's kind of a relief for me because I hem and haw and get really tied up in picking the perfect words or the titles for me. And it's just like, well, it could be whatever currently serves me now and I can always change it. Like, that's a relieving thing to know.
I change your guys' magic name once an episode.
Yeah, it's true. I have multiple names. You know, I have a stage name for each of the different bands that I might perform in, like a different name, because I'm doing something different, right? And I'm Malachor 5 on the podcast for whatever reason. I attribute this to like a multi-faced god, because ultimately, like, as magicians, we're like, especially if we're doing our job right, we're becoming godlike. And I like the idea of being multi-faced, multi-armed, multi-formed, shapeshifter, maybe can do anything that I need to do. And that's where my divinity truly is. That's how I function.
It's like an aspect of your whole self that comes out in order to get something done. You know what I mean? Like, for me, it's more utilitarian. Like, at work, I go by my given name. But then usually all my friends and acquaintances, and here I'm Mari, or Mari Sama is my, you know, if I don't know you that well on the internet, I want you to think that I'm like a goddess-like queen, you know? So it depends on the situation. But I think having the multiple facets of yourself with different names, I think that's totally viable too.
Yeah, even the bad ones, all of them together, they might have a use someday.
And then chapter 7 concludes with a warning about magical oaths. In fact, it's quite a bit like my fundamentalist neighbor's parents warned me about. It's exactly the same wisdom. They said, whatever you swear to will likely come true for better or for worse. You need to be careful what you magically agree to. If you are sworn to secrecy under the threat of death, even if the officiant doesn't kill you for posting his secrets on the internet, something else might kill you.
It's like Tony Montana says in Scarface. All I have is my word and my balls.
Yeah.
Like, the word is your law. Like, he's giving you his word. You're going to do the job. You tell somebody that. You got to do that. Like, don't go back on your word, because all you got is that in your genitals, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you break your oath or you break your word, you better be ready to handle it. You better have some stones, because it's coming. Don't break your own word.
Yeah, don't be mad when the reckoning comes because you broke your word. Like, that's your fault. You know.
You break your word, you break your balls. See, we can learn things from Hollywood movies. That's okay. We're chaos magicians. My favorite magic movie of all time is Apocalypse Now. So go watch it. Okay. And this brings us to chapter 8. Perhaps the biggest can of worms in the whole book. And the one that's most appropriate for our show. As mentioned, it's chapter 8 when things start to heat up. Finally, we arrive at the litany of esoteric correspondences one can use in ritual or art to accomplish a better result. Here, Chapman's philosophy on the subject really shines and lays things out clearer than I've ever encountered before.
So here he states, "It cannot be made too explicit that the application of complex symbolism does not mean an increase in quantitative results, but an increase in the quality of the result. With a quantitative approach to magic, the simple sigil engenders the same number of results as the overblown symbolic rite, i.e. one. But if we consider the two magical acts in a qualitative sense, the symbolic rite creates more meaningful result due to the richness of the meaning employed during the ritual. The novice must not try and run before he or she can walk. It is essential during a ritual that every element of the magical act has a clear purpose and a reason for doing it. It is better to decide what one action means and undergo that experience than to attempt to employ 1,000 symbols and not fully understand and end up confused in the middle of a cumbersome and overly cerebral rite."
I think this is an elegant explanation that every mage should hear during the early days of study. Using the appropriate associations does not get more results. It gets higher resolution ones infused with more meaning. And you shouldn't make it so complicated and so Lieber 777'd out that you can't do the ritual properly. Like, you should stay at whatever level you're comfortable with and build up to that Lieber 777 extravaganza that you imagine.
You know what's kind of funny too is that this is exactly how good design is implemented, because design is art, but it's a communicative art. Like, it's supposed to train the eye around and give information seamlessly to the people that view it. That's what he's saying here, is if you clutter it up, like, imagine, you know, the old web pages where there's like 50 moving GIFs on there and the construction notice and the web counter at the bottom. It's like a lot going on. You're not really necessarily going to get a good qualitative result just sprinkling stuff on top just to make it look cool. Like, you need to put everything there for a reason. I was like, that's spot on.
And let's take a look at the extravaganza mode, like using everything and all of it. If it's done correctly, you might not even notice. Like, if you watch a Stanley Kubrick movie, mm-hmm. or in my case, a Coppola movie like Apocalypse Now, every little piece of anything in the frame has some kind of meaning. It's so coded and densely packed with symbolism, meanings, references, mythology, memes, inside jokes, whatever, that it's just overflowing. But at the same time, if you are not looking for it, you may not even notice it. That's the genius of it. So once you get to that level, it won't get in your way. It won't be a sloppy website. It will just be your mastery expressing itself. And you're going to get a result that reflects that mastery.
I think that the From Software games embody that very well. They have a high learning curve. There's actual occultism and alchemy present in the themes of the story, but it's so occulted. And you have to, like, be focusing on all these other crazy mechanics of the game. It's a high risk, high reward. But if you are able to do it and it becomes normal to you, then, like, you get this really good example of, like, the juice was, in fact, worth the squeeze, at least in my opinion, when it comes to video games. Applying that to magic is very fun at the same time.
Well, like, the game is still playable and fun, and it attracts people who will know nothing of the amount of depth it has, right?
Yeah, and they may not even care about all the occultism and spirituality, alchemy stuff. They're just like, that game's awesome, I'm good at it. And it's just like, well, you are embodying this alchemical process of just like a normal gamer who transcended the non-hardcore realm, and now you're a hardcore gamer, or whatever the internet might call you, because you beat that hard game, and you're just like, well, I enjoyed it. I don't care about all the occultism.
But isn't it deeper than that? Like, there are plenty of hard games. There are more Souls-like copy ripoffs than we can name, right?
But especially old games.
But, like, that special feeling you get from Dark Souls or Bloodborne or whatever, it's qualitatively different than the others. Like, by the time we see Marlon Brando in Apocalypse Now, it has been built up to the point where he may as well be God or the devil or your holy guardian angel. Like, and the person watching it who doesn't know anything about those concepts can still feel it. It's still palpable. And so maybe you don't know your graphic settings, but there's something in your eyeballs that notice the higher resolution. To take it a bit further, Alvin Chapman says,
So where might we begin in order to learn this magical language for use in the magical act? How are we to make sense of so many symbols from so many traditions? If we were to accept that the universe is composed solely of ideas, and that the most elementary expression of an idea and its relationship with any other idea is mathematical in nature, would it not be possible to attribute any phenomena whatsoever to number? If it were really possible to attribute every phenomenon or every symbol to a number, we could develop not only a mnemonic system beyond parallel, but also an intuitive, coherent means of understanding every symbol in relation to every other. The symbolic complexity of a ritual would then not only be a matter of what the material symbols employ during the ritual, but on the breadth and depth of the magician's symbolic association developed by using such a numerical system as outlined above. Thankfully for us, such a system already exists and seems to have existed in various cultures around the world for millennia. Today we know it as the Kabbalah.
So if you're a longtime listener, you may have already figured out that the whole rabbit absolutely loves Kabbalistic association, which extends well into the realm of number sequences. In fact, our series on the major arcana of the tarot has only been able to reach its desired depth due to our willingness to follow clues that were embedded on purpose into each of the cards using this Kabbalistic method of numerology, which is more properly referred to as Gematria. I giggle a little bit while saying it because there's at least a handful of listeners of this show that are vocal about this in the Discord that they don't believe in Gematria because it's just too wacky.
Bro, and I remember that guy.
Yeah,
he was an asshole.
Oh man, we had someone jump into the chat and be like, hey man, I saw your stuff about the movie Mandy and all the secret stuff. Haha, man, you should check out these symbols I found.
He was like, look at all this, like the government is lying and there's propaganda everywhere and the Satanists. And we're like, yeah, we know that. And then we're like, check out Gematria and, you know, Kabbalah. And he's like, that shit doesn't, that's not real.
It's like, oh, come on, man. You go on and believe weird stuff, but...
I mean, I don't know. The thing is, this is such an old system. It's almost the same as I Ching as well. Like, it's very, very, very specific, and you can apply it to everything, and it tends to pan out. And he's like, why would they put code in the form of numbers in, like, popular culture and stuff? It's like, it's because they're working spell work through media and stuff. That's what we were talking about. And he was like, I don't believe you, but he believed all this other shit about lizard people controlling the government or whatever.
I mean, in terms of Gematria specifically, you know, I've spent years, you know, making associations, but I also think that it's not the only official language of magic. It might be old code to the Matrix, and it might be a thirst trap getting stuck in just this, like, oh, I keep finding all these numbers. So you might be wrong. Like, it might not have any connection to each other, especially if you're not a speaker of the language, like, because then you're not voicing these things. So, like, ideas of, like, English Gematria make a lot of sense to me after reading a book that, you know, was talking about that. It's like, yeah, that's the language you speak. You should make your associations on a divine level based off of that, especially if you're a Kabbalist and the Book of the Law was dictated in English, like, kind of open another perspective. And I was like, oh, wait, maybe that's how I should be looking at this number letter association. But I'm also not trying to disrespect the Hebrew language because I love the connections I've figured out on the podcast and, you know, making episodes out of it. It's kind of easy and interesting.
But it is used a lot, quite a bit.
And it is.
It's a popular system. And if you were to choose to use it as a tool, building your spell work or what words or symbols you use in your rituals using that system, probably a good idea, unless you prefer a different system. It's just one of many.
I mean, almost nobody needs to be told that the number 666 is special. You know, non-believers are like, oh God, it's the number. But, like, it applies to other numbers too. It's just 666 is a great example because, in the Bible, it says it's the number of man. And then I love to point out that humans, as carbon-based life forms, what's carbon on the periodic table?
It has 6 valence electrons.
And 6 neutrons and 6 protons, unless it's an isotope. So it is the number of man. It also starts as this black, like, acrid substance that, after enough time and pressure, can become clear and translucent, like a diamond. So it's a good metaphor for things. And if you're really into your study, then you'll find lots of interesting things like that in your Gematria quest. So to level up in Gematria, Chapman has some exercises. So nothing is left out. Number one, choose a Kabbalah, which could mean Hebrew, Greek, Latin, English, gone. That's Gematria of nothing. It's a very cool chaos magic system of Gematria that now is very hard to find generators for online, but you can learn it yourself. Although it's nice to have a database, you can purchase a good book on the subject and then memorize the alphabet with its numerical values. We can show you a cool PDF if you happen to come to the Discord, for instance, and that will make it a lot easier. 2, develop a book of numbers. This is pretty ambitious. Write down every number from 0 to 1,000. I don't even know if I can do that. Then you work out the numerical value of all the ideas that are important to you using the Kabbalah you have chosen. Then you write them next to the corresponding number, add words as and when necessary. So you gotta go full nerd if you're gonna follow this exercise. You just go like, you're gonna need like 2 pairs of nerd glasses and just switch them out every page. 3, you should study the Tree of Life and work out where each word in your book of numbers belongs. That's kind of exciting. And then you gotta learn more about the Tree of Life, and it's like, oh man. 4, study all possible mathematical relationships and ascertain what these relationships mean for the ideas to which you apply them. Woo! So what is so special about the number 36, or 88, or 49? What makes these numbers qualitatively different from their quantitative value? See, I can use big words. And then 5, classify every phenomenon you experience in terms of the Tree of Life until it's habitual. Or you could just listen to the whole rabbit because we'll do it for you. and this is sounds like it's horrible, awful studying, but dude, it makes watching amazing movies 10 times as amazing when you realize that some of these folks actively do this stuff. Even if it's not just numbers, it usually does involve numbers and it can be symbols, and they correspond in a way where you get an even better insight of the director's mind, his creative juices, you could say. And then, if you're a real believer in magic, these things can happen spontaneously. You can even analyze your own work using these methods to gain a better understanding of where your subconscious mind is going and doing. It's a true pleasure. And Chapman suggests if you want to know how powerful this stuff actually is, experiment using rituals or magic both with and without these correspondences. Now, in regards to what I said earlier about analyzing your own material using this method, Aleister Crowley claims that the intricacies of Gematria in his own Book of the Law supersedes his own ability by such an extent, he feels the need to point it out as proof that the Book of the Law was channeled by a non-human intelligence that vastly exceeds our own.
If you think about it, the statistics for that being randomly generated from somebody just babbling, you know, those correspondences, that's like slim to none. So it's kind of a good argument.
At its very worst, if it's not a channeled message, it's a work of art that's a masterpiece at its very least. It's quite the tale. The Book of the Law, to be specific.
And so if you're writing a piece of poetry about, let's say, blood, and you get the number 44 when you break it all down,
yeah,
you must have tapped into something, because that's the Hebrew numerical gematria of that particular word. Maybe find out what it means in English. Yeah.
That's my favorite number.
40, mem, and dalet, 4, 44, dim, it means blood.
Wow.
And those two words also kind of mean water door.
Oh, this is going
to
be cool.
But if you'd like to keep nerding out about the intricacies of magic and get into the more advanced stuff in Alan Chapman's book of Advanced Magic for Beginners, then please visit www.patreon.com/thewholerabbit, where your monthly donation of just $5 will not only get you the second half of this episode, it will get you the second half of all our episodes, which are conveniently compatible with Spotify. You can just whip out the app and listen to all our episodes, and honestly, Spotify keeps them in order much better than anything else. Aside from that, I will also send you a 5x5 high-quality vinyl sticker of our Big Bunny Baphomet cover art so you can become a really weird Knights Templar as well. But not only that, I'll send you the secret keys to the temple where you can enter in to the hollowed chambers of our Discord and analyze the divinatory messages of the giant mechanical robot head that dispenses our fate in the form of highly confusing divination and messages from the beyond. Thank you, everybody. Eat carrots and shoot lasers.
Pew, pew, pew. you.